The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, well, usually we have a little small talk at the start of the episode, but I don't think we've got time this week, have we? We've just been swamped by questions from our patrons. We better just dive straight into it.
Yeah, no time for that. We're both fine. Let's get on with the questions.
Absolutely. So let's firstly welcome in our guest this week with Kawasaki riding high at the top of the J1 table. It's always a pleasure to welcome Neil Debnam back to the pod. Neil, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Yeah, no pleasantries necessary here either. So, yeah. Pleased you are, and I am too. So.
And yeah, thank you. And well, yeah, plenty of questions for you from our patrons as well, Neil. That we're definitely putting you to work on this appearance on the pod, and no question about that. So, of course, we're coming off the back of Kawasaki's doubleheader against second-placed Nagoya. Listeners, we didn't really touch on the first of those games in last week's podcast because we put out a Patreon exclusive episode the night of with Sam and I dissecting that game. But the second of those games was played last Tuesday, so the day that last week's podcast was released. And in round two, the second leg of the top of the table clash, Frontale came out victors again, this time 3-2 over Grampus at Todoroki. Sam, I'll come to you first on this game. We knew that Nagoya simply had to be better this second time around. If Kazuki Nagasawa's shot in the ninth minute had have gone in, things might have turned out a little bit different. I think this was a case in the first half of Nagoya not quite taking their chances, and obviously Kawasaki making them pay in a ruthless fashion.
Yeah, I think so. Nagoya were a lot better to start that game, and they kept it a lot tighter defensively. And yeah, they were a bit more adventurous going forward. But once you don't take your chances against Kawasaki, they'll flip a switch, as they did in this game. They then went up three goals to nil at that point. But then Nagoya showed a lot of fight as well to come back into the game. So although they've lost the series by, two games, I think their performance in that second game, and especially the fight back afterwards, I think it was a positive sign for Nagoya. I mean, the 6 points lost are not great in a title race, but I think they came out of it as little scathed as possible after the way they were dismantled in the first game.
Indeed. So, Neil, yeah, that first game, that can't have gone any better for you as a Frontale supporter. Obviously, winning 4-0 away at your closest challenges was an absolute dismantling. And then, Sam said you got into a 3-0 lead here with Jeziel heading in an Aotanaka corner just past the half hour. But, the second half was better from Nagoya, but, yeah, two perfect results from your point of view.
Yeah, I think it's more than, certainly more than I hoped we would get. I would have settled for a couple of draws probably, but it's lovely to get that 6 point cushion. It wasn't particularly comfortable, and also it wasn't pretty, which slipped out of my mouth and is actually true. But and there was last few games, I think we spent quite a lot of time at the end of games trying to shield the ball in the corner flag. But I think it's kind of job done. It was going to be a huge sort of obstacle for us, and it couldn't really have gone better from results point of view.
Indeed. So yeah, I mentioned Nagasawa's early chance for Grampus, then yeah, Jeziel heading Kawasaki ahead. Sure, Inagaki's 25-yard shot was saved by Jun Sung Ryong just before half time. So yeah, a couple of decent chances for Grampus, but yeah, they weren't taken in the first half, and then Frontale went 2-0 up 5 minutes after the break when Kaoru Mitoma beat Shunpei Naruse down the left and fizzed across into the 6-yard box. And Miki Yamane slid in and fired home. Neil, I notice in your writings in recent times that you were bemoaning the fact that Yamane hadn't had a break in recent games. But, the fact that your right back is sliding in to tap in inside the 6-yard box is another example, if any more were needed, of the total football that your team plays. And Yamane is, he's a repeat offender, scoring goals like this, isn't he?
Yeah, it's funny. I think maybe I'm the one who needs the break because it clearly, the multiple games doesn't seem to be affecting him much. But I feel like recently he's been a bit more conservative maybe, or maybe he's been told to be a little bit more conservative. And just as I was writing that note during the game, he popped up in the centre forward position and scored from Mitoma's cross. So, I mean, I know nothing, and it's constantly highlighted to me by life and the world. But it's a delight to have him playing for us, and it's a bit of luck he's not getting tired, because we haven't got anyone else who Onyeki seems willing to play there. So long may his good striking form continue from the right back position.
Yeah, an amazing player and a fantastic signing, obviously, from Shaunan Belmare. So it was 2-0 to Frontale, 5 minutes into the second half. And Sam, what can you say about the third goal? An absolute gift. Grampus, as we know, setting clean sheet records last season and well and truly on track to better that this year. But, Yuichi Maruyama and Mitch Langerak getting their wires crossed. And usually you hear a lot of Mitch Langerak bellowing instructions to his defence, don't you? I'm not sure whether he shouted, leave it or not, to Maruyama, or it's mine. But I didn't think there was a call from Langerak, and Maruyama simply passed the ball past him and into his own net. A horror show for the Grampus defence.
Yeah, communication is not really a weak point usually for Langerak, so it's strange that these two players, of all players, kind of got their wires crossed and got a bit confused. And I'm going to have to assume that there isn't a shout from Langerak, because Mariam passes it to where you'd expect him to pass it to, where you'd expect the goalkeeper to be, and Langerak's just not there. So, yeah, I think maybe there's not a shout from Langerak, but yeah, I'm not 100% sure. But it was a real mess and a complete horror show for two very, usually very dependable players.
Indeed. Now, we'd spoken earlier on in the season, and as far back as the Super Cup, about Kawasaki's tendency, Neil, to kind of switch off in the second half of games once you're seemingly in cruise control and get stung on from time to time. Obviously, that's about the best thing that Gumba's done all season, is that fight back in the second half of the Super Cup. But again, here, yeah, Grampus finally pulled a goal back with just under 20 minutes to go. It was Sho Inagaki yet again with a superb strike for Grampus. And then, Mateus certainly made things interesting inside the last 10 minutes. So did you feel there was a bit of a switching off happening from Frontale, and you were made to pay there? Or was this just a case of Nagoya were due, and at some stage over the course of these two games they were going to get you?
A bit of both, I think. I felt like the Inagaki goal came from a bit of a kind of sloppy defending from us. It was a nice finish, but I felt like we didn't really get rid of it when we should have done. I can't quite remember it very clearly because I'd consumed some drinks at that stage because the game was going well. And the Mateus, I mean, you can't take anything away from that. Although, was it a shot? I don't know. It was fantastic anyway. And it even made that grumpy-looking guy smile a bit. So, yeah, full credit to him for that. But I think, yeah, I don't know if we switch off or we run out of steam, but I think we haven't quite got to grips with making subs this year so far. And last year, one of Onyeki's newfound strengths was sort of match-changing subs. But I feel like maybe since last year, his match-changing subs are now starting the games and then the sort of the match-changing subs are there maybe, but we're just not doing it at the right time or in the right order or in the right positions. So I feel like, I mean, yeah, we switch off a bit. I think we take a foot off the accelerator and the subs don't ever really seem to change much. Of course, there's probably numerous things to contradict this that I've forgotten, but that's the way it feels to me.
Well, like Saturday, for example, that we're going to come on to, and the score of the second goal and the person that set him up. But yes, no, I take your point. And Sam, so you've said all season, teams simply have to try and take Kawasaki on, and you mentioned that Grampus were better in this game, especially in the second half. So was that? Is this instructive for other teams? I mean, obviously, if you come out and try and play against Kawasaki, you could easily get battered 5-0. But, if you don't, you could easily just get beat 5-0 and they'll just play straight through you. So was this, as you said, it was somewhat somewhat constructive for Grampus and hopefully for the rest of the teams that will come up against Frontale in games to come. Because if you don't have a crack, then you never stand a chance, do you?
Yeah, I think these two games are a perfect kind of blueprint for teams, because the first game, Nagoya just sat so deep and Kawasaki just wandered through them. So it was, if you're going to get beaten anyway, you might as well have a go. And Nagoya did that. They kept it a little bit tight. They were in the game a lot more. There were that moment, I think there was one goal, the Yamane goal actually, where Nagoya are trying to press, but then they get themselves pulled out of position, which I think is what they were worried about in the first game. So that allowed Yamane to have quite a free run into the goal. So that is going to happen when you play that way against Kawasaki. But as you've seen with Nagoya, with Gamba, and with the occasional other team, if you have a go at them, yeah, there is a way into the game. You're probably still going to lose, but at least it's not completely meekly sitting back and being completely outplayed and battered. So, yeah, I think this is the way to go. And Gamba obviously weren't listening and weren't watching for the way they played on Saturday.
Indeed. So, yeah, coming into these two games, it looked like a race in two for the title, of course, with Nagoya just 3 points behind Frontale. But after, two straight Kawasaki wins, the gap at the top was opened up to 9 points. And then Nagoya were obviously closer to third place to Tosu at the start of match day 13 than they were to the defending champions. So, yeah, two events at the Panasonic Stadium on Saturday then, when Kawasaki visited 18th-placed Gamba Osaka. Of course, this was the clash of last season's top two, Frontale riding high again, but Gamba obviously struggling mightily down at the foot of the table, albeit, as we've said throughout, with so many games still to make up after their COVID-19 troubles. Mr. Oniki made three changes from Tuesday. He brought in Kurumaya for Taniguchi, Wakizaka for Nobori Zato, which meant that the Kawasaki Swiss Army Knife Reo Hatate switched back to left back, and he brought in Tatsuya Hasegawa for Kaoru Mitoma, shuffled his pack and worked his magic, you might say, as those moves paid off in both goals of Kawasaki's 2-0 away win. Again here, Neil, there was an early chance for Takashi Usami around about the same time as Nagasawa had his for Grampus. And again, it's just a case of, I think you can take your light blue and black glasses off and see that, yeah, obviously teams need to make a decent start against your side, or they can just get swallowed up, can't they? So we knew about Gamba's troubles in front of goals coming in, and then Usami a decent chance but missed the target, and then once again your side made them pay.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Take chances and get a bit of luck along the way. So certainly things could have gone differently in both or all three of these games. Or maybe not the first Nagoya one. That was kind of I don't know. But Gamba looked pretty. I'm going to offend people here, but I thought they looked pretty lackluster. And I don't know. I would worry for Gamba a little bit. But you're right. They had like a couple of good chances, but I think that was it, wasn't it? It was just a couple of good chances, and I think our keeper only had to make a couple of saves in the game. So, yeah, it's. I don't think it's as plain sailing as maybe our sort of points total and our goals total would suggest, but maybe we're just riding that sort of wave of luck at the moment somehow, I hope. I don't know.
Well, I think you're really, really good, Neil. So, you don't really need to worry about luck, but I guess you make your own. But so in the 20th minute, Yao Schmidt headed a Wakizaka corner down towards goal. It was pushed onto the post by Masaki Higashiguchi. And then, Sam, the opener four minutes before half-time came as a result of a Kawasaki counter-attack after Takashi Usami had crossed from the right, and from there, with the ball running free, Yamane, Ienaga and Wakizaka combined to set up Hasegawa, who was in for Mitoma, but you couldn't really tell the difference, as Hasegawa had an excellent game in his time on the pitch. The ball broke for Leandro Damião with the defender scrambling back, and Damião blasted home from just inside the penalty spot. So in the blink of an eye, with Gamba threatening, Frontale took it up the other end and scored.
Yeah, it's quite easy for us to say, I think, go and attack Kawasaki, but then they can do this to you on the counter-attack when you do that. And yeah, Hasegawa had a very good game. Last season, right at the start of it, he was playing absolutely superbly before he got injured, and keeping Mitoma out of the side. And you wonder where Mitoma would be if Hasegawa didn't get injured, but maybe that's just a conversation for another day. But yeah, I thought he played very well. He was up against poor Yota Sato in for his second professional game for Gamba, just because they've lost all right backs. Fukuda missed that this game. They've already got Takao out, and Onose was out, who's also filled in. So the poor guy was up against one of the strongest left sides you'll see in the league. And Ichimi was playing right wing, which he doesn't offer much support. So, yeah, he faced Hatate and Wakizaka and Hasegawa here. And Ianaga comes across. So, yeah, I felt really sorry for him. But, yeah, Hasegawa does really well to get across, get past him. Gets a little bit of luck in the way the ball ricochets into the area. And then falls to Damian, who's not going to miss from there. And, yeah, once Kawasaki take the lead against you, you're in trouble. And, yeah, I think Kawasaki pretty much controlled things from then on.
And, Neil, yeah, Damião has really come into his own this year, hasn't he? He's been an absolute force of nature and second in the Golden Boot race at the moment to Anderson Lopez, who went back on top with his brace over the weekend. It will come to later on, obviously. But I know Kobayashi's out of the team injured at the moment. But, yeah, Damião is definitely in the first team. He is definitely there on merit. He is he's become the man up front for your side, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think this is what we expected, and some other people expected when we signed him, that he would be quite so sort of dominant. And certainly, yeah, his position has been strengthened by Kobayashi's injury, but I think even before Kobayashi got injured, it was pretty clear that this year Damião's the number one. And yeah, I think it's really nice to have a player up there in the scoring charts, because normally recently we've been spreading it around a bit more. And I think I looked at it the other day and he's got like 7 assists as well, which is just, I mean, when you think about the amount of goals that guy's been involved with, it's like, it must be 2/3 of our goals maybe or something like that, which is pretty impressive. And yeah, I think we all absolutely love him at the moment. And I think he's having a good time. He was captain, I think, for the first time ever on, what day was it? Saturday or Sunday? I can't remember. Golden Week has messed me up badly. Saturday. Was it Saturday?
That's right.
So he was captain for the first time on Saturday. And I don't know, that seemed to sort of be a big thing for him as well. And yeah, it's we're really, really delighted to have him at the moment. And he's even sort of starting his own sort of insanity thing on Twitter, where he'll congratulate everybody, all his teammates, with the same phrase, and that seems to be passing around the internet as well now. So, and he liked my Twitter post on Saturday. I mean, to be honest, I was trying to get a like from him by tagging him and putting a picture of him and saying "Joga Muito" or whatever it is. So I felt pretty cheap afterwards, but yeah, even though I put the ball in the back of the net. So,
Have you noticed like an increase in his leadership role, just the way he kind of plays and presses from the front? I just think this season it's sort of switched on for him that he has to get involved in all that pressing, and the ground he covers have been absolutely incredible this season.
Yeah, the pressing is insane. And I think, I guess it must have been, was it the Super Cup? Or maybe it was like the last game of last season, because they all kind of, there wasn't a big break, was there? But for like 2 or 3 games in a row, he would celebrate blocking a goal kick from the keeper as much as he did when he scored a goal. And it was like, this guy's really up for it this year. And yeah, it's great. I don't know if he's sort of verbally a leader on the field. I mean, I'm never sure how much communication there goes on. And I mean, I always like it when I see a Brazilian player chatting with the ref, and I wonder quite what's being said in what language and who understands what. But definitely, yeah, his 100% effort thing is really rubbing off on everyone else. And I don't know, he says he wants to sign a new contract with us. And also, I mean, this is kind of, I don't know why I've linked this together, but he used to make quite a shriek when he got tackled or fouled, like a real sort of surprisingly feminine shriek. And he stopped doing that, and I think since he stopped doing that, he's not he's probably getting more fouls given to him. Now, hang on. He's probably getting more free kicks for fouls against him. And I don't know, I think it's like that kind of image that some people have of a big money foreign signing in the J League comes in as a bit of a prima donna, but now he just seems like he's one of the lads, and his celebrations, he seems like he's hugely loved by the other players and the fans. So I could wax lyrical for him about him for ages, but I feel a little bit guilty because I haven't bought his shirt this year. I changed this year, so maybe that's it. Maybe that's why he's doing better, because he hasn't got the curse of my shirt or my support. So.
Yeah, well, interesting to hear. He's not the only Leandro you've been interacting with on Twitter in recent times, Neil. But that's great stuff. Always good to get a like from one of your favourite players. That's absolutely brilliant. So into the second half then, and Gumba, they didn't have too many chances in this game, but there was a key save made by Jun Sung Ryong on Takashi Osami's low blast at his near post in the 66th minute, and then 10 minutes later, the aforementioned Swiss Army knife Hatate, who was now back in midfield after Noborizato came on with Kaoru Toma in the 70th minute, Hatate won the ball back in the centre circle, and Noborizato played the ball over the top for Mitoma, who raced away from the previously mentioned Yota Sato, who had tried his guts out, but unfortunately was picked on for both goals. And Mitoma flashed a superb strike across Higashiguchi and inside his far post to seal that 2-0 win that kept Frontale 9 points clear at the top of the table. Gumba still stuck down in 18th with just 2 goals scored from their 9 games so far. All right, so we'll segue on to some of these questions that we got for you, Neil, and for us as a whole on Kawasaki. So the first one of these concerns Kaoru Mitoma, who obviously has been the breakout star of the last season and a half in the J-League. So Kang from Patreon has a multi-part question regarding Mitoma. If an offer from Europe comes for him, do you think he should stay or should he go? Do you think he's outgrown the J-League now and should move overseas to develop his career? And if so, what kind of club should he be looking to join? Neil, I can't imagine you want Mitoma to leave, because he's been absolutely sensational for your team in the past, as I say, year and a half. But I don't know, can you see that it might be time for him to go in this, when the close season comes in Europe?
I think probably we're expecting it to happen. It'd be nice if he hung around to the end of the year, but from a selfish point of view, I think he should go nowhere. He should just stay and keep scoring. But I have to admit that I should probably be pleased for our players when they sign for overseas big team or get national call ups. I mean, personally, I don't want them to ever leave our training ground or something, or well, they can go to a game, but I don't want them to ever leave our beautiful Kawasaki enclave. But it could be time. I'm not going to push him away, and I don't know. I mean, the J League does seem to be the place where players leave really, really quickly, really, really early before they've even done much. I mean, I think I was at a Frontale Gamba game in Suita, where it was, I can't remember which one of them it was, but one of their players was leaving to go overseas. And I was like, I don't really know this name. And checked and he'd played like 10 games or something like that. So, wow, this is like a huge ceremony for it as well. And it's nice for once that he's doing the business here before he goes anywhere. But, I don't know. I mean, What happens with transfers in the J League anyway to foreign clubs? It's never money, is it? It's always a loan with a view to a free transfer. So, I mean, I don't know if that's why our players don't leave as much. Maybe we're a bit tougher on that, although Itakura and Miyoshi both went for nothing. So yeah, that's, and Morita probably. And I think we got money for Morita. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I'm going around in circles. I don't want him to go. But if he does go, I hope he goes somewhere. Well, sort of one of two options. Either he goes somewhere that is sort of a decent level. Like, I don't know, I think I saw Sam talking about this on Twitter. Was it like Portugal or Netherlands or something like that? Or, yeah, so I'd want him to do that. I don't want him to go, like, I mean, who needs to go to Belgium? I'm sorry, I love Belgium. It's like my favourite country in the world. Fantastic beer. Great, weird, really weird music, strange art. It's really love Belgium, but why any J League player goes to the Belgian League, I have no idea, because it's not exactly top quality, is it? So I hope he doesn't go to a dodgy league. I hope he doesn't go to a huge league and never play. I hope if the move happens, it's the right move for him and he can actually do something. So. But yeah, he can stay. You know, I won't object if he stays.
Yeah, fair enough. That, well, I mean, it's worth remembering, though, isn't it, Sam, that, I mean, he's about to turn 24, Mitoma, and he's only in his, as I said, broke out last season, so he's only in his second full J1 season. And as you said yourself, yeah, he might not have got that many opportunities at all last season if Tatsuya Hasegawa hadn't have gotten injured early doors. But yeah, at the age of 24 and in the form that he's in, as much as it might, as much as it might pain Neil, I mean, it looks to me like if he is serious about wanting to go, then unfortunately, as much as we all love watching him in J1, then I think the timing is absolutely right.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is the perfect age for him to go. He's done. Yeah, he's had an incredible kind of whirlwind year and a bit in the J League. And usually, if players only have that amount of time, I think maybe they could do with an extra year or two of seasoning in the J League. But I think Mitoma is right up there. I think if there's an offer that comes in for him, I think this is the time to move. I'd prefer him to move in the summer as well rather than the winter, because I think it's always difficult when you're having to try and integrate into a European squad when you've just come to the end of your own grueling season. You're in the middle and going into the business end of a European season. It's never usually easy to integrate. So I think if you can get there in the summer and have a summer with the team, I know this year it'd probably be at the Olympics, which would harm it slightly, but yeah, I'd be looking for him to go this summer. And I mean, I gave away Tanaka on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, so now Mitoma's going, so Frontale fans won't like me. But yeah, I think, yeah, Mitoma, this is, if there's an offer there, I think he should take it.
If you're listening, Karu, by the way, and you want an English teacher before you go, I'm looking for students at the moment, and I'm very reasonably priced, so...
And you can find Neil on Twitter, Karu, at Frontale Rabbit. He is always open for business. All right, well, yeah, Kang, thanks very much for that question on Mitoma. Well, yeah, Sam, sorry, just to go back to it very ever so briefly, what kind of a club or, yeah, what league, if you have a specific club or league in mind, where do you think he should go? Maybe as a first stepping stone to a long career in Europe that Kang says he hopes Mitoma will end up having.
Well, I mean, it depends on the clubs that are interested. If you've got a big club available, I wouldn't be going to, say, a Real Madrid, a Man City, where you're not going to be used, you're just going to be loaned out, and you kind of go wherever they fancy you going there. Like, Meschino went to Man City and ended up in Scotland, which is completely the wrong move for him, so I wouldn't be doing that. But if, say, an Ajax or a Dortmund, a big team that has got a lot of history at playing young players, putting them in early, I'd say take that opportunity. If that's not available, I think the leagues that are best, I wouldn't go to Belgium, although it did work out for Tomiyasu. But I think I'd look at Portugal, I'd look at Holland, and I'd look at Germany. I mean, Stuttgart has been mentioned to me on Twitter, and I think that's, yeah, I mean, what Arendo's doing fantastically there. You've just got to pick the right team. I think if Mitoma went to a defensive team in any of those leagues, I think it wouldn't work out for him at all. I think he needs the freedom initially. So, yeah, one of those leagues, play for a team that has an expansive brand of football, get your feet in there. I think that would be perfect for him. But, yeah, don't end up at Man City and then go off to Scotland, because it'll only go and ruin your career.
Yeah, I was going to say, Neil, was it Meschino, the Gumba player you were thinking of before, that ceremony after he'd played about 10 games?
Yeah, could well have been, actually.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, off you go to Hearts.
indeed. All right, well, so next to, Johnny Nichols, a question for you, Neil, and... Well, yeah, this is it's quite in-depth, but it's a Johnny Nichols special. It's an absolute cracking question. Why do you think Kawasaki have been able to pull so far ahead of similarly or better-backed rivals like Marino's, Urawa, Gumba, etc.? Specifically, how do you manage to retain young talent for so long and consistently find hidden gems in the domestic market?
Yeah, easy question, this one.
That's a ripper, yeah.
I thought about this because you sent me the question earlier, and I thought about it as I was walking to the station earlier and had some fantastic ideas, which I forgot to write down. But I think stability is quite a big thing, in that I feel like we stick with kind of a general system for quite a long time, that sort of Kazama built it, Oniki tweaked it, and made it successful. I think we don't chop and change the squad so much. It's like always a few changes rather than sort of like wholesale players coming and going. That's a couple of things. And, you know, we don't sack the manager after he has a disastrous 2019 in the Champions League and sort of a very disappointing league campaign, even though some bloggers might want him gone. We stick with him. And, yeah, so I think stability is a big thing. As for sort of picking up hidden gems, I think, yeah, I haven't got a clue. But it's weird that somehow it's almost like we're choosing players on how they will fit into our sort of group and our sort of, I hate to use this word, but vibe. Yamane, I don't know if Yamane was being courted by lots of other clubs, but he was playing centre back in a pretty poorly performing Shonan team. And when I heard we're signing a Shonan defender, I was thinking, is this really a good idea? And I think we talked about Ian Argo last time, or the previous time I was on here, that he was he's a big name at that stage, but he wasn't setting the world alight. And somehow it seems that when players join us, they fit in. And I don't know if that's a scouting thing, that they scout the personality as well as the sort of the things they can do on the field, or whether it's just lucky, or whether I feel like we have this image of being sort of a friendly, nice club, like too nice for many people's ways of thinking. And it does, I can't really remember, I can think of one notable exception, but I can't really remember of us ever having any kind of troublemakers in the squad. Like, not saying, like, I mean, I'm sure you'll come on to some certain sort of spats later in the episode, but player and manager spats and things like that. But it does seem like people like being at Frontale, and I think that's definitely the vibe helps. And I think, like, the fans are supportive, the club are supportive to the players, and everybody kind of likes getting on with each other. There's not so much criticism, apart from certain bloggers sometimes. But I feel a bit guilty about that. But I think stability is one big thing. I don't know. And this is kind of an obvious thing to say, but success breeds success, I suppose. And now that we did well, we snatched that league title in, oh God, what year was it? I should know this. The first league title, we snatched that on the last day, which I think the way we snatched it out of Kashima's hands was a real ego boost, morale boost to us. And that sort of carried over into the next season. And I think, yeah, as long as things keep going well, I think, yeah, success breeds success. But yeah, I think that was about it. And maybe just Kawasaki water is nice. I don't know, because a lot of famous players have come from there recently. Well, Saito Manabu was Kawasaki lad. And there's this guy who used to play for your team. I can't remember what his name was. He plays for like Spanish C League team now. I can't remember what. Yeah. Sorry, this is an appalling joke. But yeah, Kubo was a Kawasaki boy as well. So maybe that's it. Kawasaki water, Kawasaki fruit and vegetables grown from the side of the Tama River. And a great vibe. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a combination of things. And I shouldn't say that. But yeah, I do wonder from time to time. It's a great sliding doors moment, isn't it? That the final day of the 2017 season when the serial winners, Kashima, you know, bottled it and handed the title to serial bridesmaids Kawasaki. And basically, yeah, since then, Neil, you just haven't looked back, have you? And getting over the line that first time obviously has broken your duck, broken the seal, and now you're well and truly away. And breaking all sorts of records last year, and can you believe it, Sam? They're actually on a better pace than last season. I don't know if you've checked recently, but in their first 15 games of the 2020 season, they took 38 points. They're up to 41 from their first 15 this season. So we wondered what they would do for an encore, and it turns out they're even better than they were last season. I mean, Sam, you've just sold off Tanaka and Mitoma after they've obviously lost Morita in the close season. So I'm sure a couple more young gems will come through to replace them. But is there anything that you can put it down to? Is it consistency of system that keeps them ticking over so nicely? And with the personnel don't seem to they obviously matter, but yeah, they can be switched in and out fairly effectively.
Yeah, I think those two points that Neil said are the main thing, because the move from Kazama to Oniki was only very slight tweaks that Oniki made, and Kazama just didn't quite have it defensively, and Oniki just sharpened that up, and then he's just not done anything major. Like, say, Urawa was mentioned by Johnny, and they went from Petrovic to a complete different system completely. They just didn't get to grips with it, and they've been fighting that ever since, whereas Kawasaki have just had that base layer that has been good, and then they've just built on that. And the players, yeah, they've lost a couple of players, but generally speaking, they've got a player ready to go. Like Nara left and Jesse L steps in, Morita left this season, Zhao Schmidt has come in, has been fantastic, and that's kind of the way it's been, other than that right back bit where El Senior went and then he didn't have anyone for a couple of years. But other than that, yeah, they've usually had someone just to step in quite nicely. So they've not really been in a situation like Gamba where every time one of their players hits the first team, they're gone immediately. They've managed to be able to just breed this team. This team has come through for over the last few years, the base of this. And yeah, I mean, you get a little bit of luck as well, as you mentioned, that final day of the season. You wonder if last season, if there wasn't COVID, if there wasn't the complete schedule nightmare, would Yokohama have built on their season before and then gone on and be in the situation that Kawasaki are in? We don't know. So there are a few things like that. But yeah, it's been so consistent from Kawasaki in the way that the other major teams haven't been able to do that for one reason or another.
Yeah, absolutely remarkable recent run of success for Frontale. And it obviously shows no signs of abating. And I guess the final frontier for your club, Neil, obviously we're not handing you the title yet, and I know for a fact that you're not a generally confident person, so you won't be claiming that the title is gone, even though you're 9 points clear after 15 games. But yeah, obviously the Champions League is a huge carrot that the club will be chasing this year. Before we move on to a couple of questions about that, though, and one of them is from Charlotte Patterson. Charlotte asked, can Kawasaki go all season undefeated? Neil, I know for a fact you're not going to answer that. So, Sam, can Kawasaki go all season undefeated?
I mean, they can. I mean, they can beat anyone. You'd expect they'd be favourites for every game that they play against. But I think it's a really difficult ask. I mean, last season there was that one random game against Consadole Sapporo where a defeat just came out of nowhere. So you've got to think down the line something is going to get them. Their schedule is still going to be really tough before the ACL and then afterwards. So I think eventually someone will beat them. But I mean, if there's any team that's going to go unbeaten and invincible, then this is probably the one.
Yep, and well, Charlotte goes on to ask, or do you think they may find it challenging once the Champions League starts? And on a similar vein, we had a question from one of our newest patrons, Michael, on the Champions League in general, and then also about Kawasaki's performances in it in recent years, Neil. So, firstly, Sam, what's the latest news from the AFC on those two outstanding groups where the venues were not confirmed?
Yeah, we actually have some news. I think it came in about 10 minutes after the question did, which was good timing. But yeah, the remaining two groups, they're going to Uzbekistan. So you've got the three in Thailand, the two in Uzbekistan. So at least that is sorted. I mean, it's just, I wouldn't like to play in Uzbekistan or Thailand in June and July. It's going to be melting. But at least something is sorted and we look like the group stage is going to take place in June, because I know the AFC Cup has had a few issues with countries pulling out, and I think that's currently postponed. So that's unfortunate for them, but I'm glad that we've got the group stage. It seems to be set in stone now, but you never know with the AFC.
Yeah, fair enough then. So, Neil, Michael goes on to ask, he's been checking out the J-League this season and obviously has noticed that Kawasaki have been by far the best side in the league. But when he's looked up their performances in the Champions League, they've not done brilliantly. Is there a particular reason for this over the years? And will they see this year as the year they will push themselves to go far in the tournament?
Before I answer that, I should just say that I'm absolutely delighted about Uzbekistan. I'm really chuffed. What a dream location that is. I hope to be able to go there myself and visit the Amir Timur Museum in Tashkent. It's been a long time entry on my bucket list. So, I just hope that we can go to these matches. but yeah, the ACL things. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we haven't done well, that's for sure. But I think comments about our uselessness they've spread like wildfire with certain people. But I think they are quite exaggerated. I mean, in the sort of the modern era, I did a bit of stat searching. And in the modern era, sort of 20 to the modern era, it's like, I don't know why I'm trying to crowbar this phrase into here, but I'll keep saying it. In the modern era, we've been in there three times, and like the first time, 2017, we did get to the quarterfinals, and we were 3-1 up in the first leg before we got a slightly dubious red card. I seem to remember because I was at the game, but dubious because it was against Urawa, so I don't think they should ever have red cards awarded to the opposition teams. So, and Kurumaya got sent off and everything fell to pieces. So, I mean, we were pretty close to the semi-final then, which I'd say is a decent performance. Admittedly, losing to Urawa was disappointing. You'd hope to at least get booted out by a sort of mega bucks Chinese Super League team. But, you know, that's we can just dream about these things. The next year was a disaster, yeah, I admit it. Really disaster. First choice players, but just complete disaster. I don't know why. And 2019, we were only 1 point off qualifying, and we're in a group with, I think, two league champions from China and Korea, or was it China and Australia? But Ulsan and Shanghai, one of those Shanghai teams, always, or was it Guangzhou? I don't know. One of these big teams always, or one or two of these big teams always seem to end up in our group. And we lost two of those games in the final minutes, and it's just, yeah, we were unlucky that year as well, I think. But after attempting to set the story of the modern era straight, I will answer the question, and which is, I think we've gone on record as saying this is the target this year, which might contribute to us going sort of full on for this, the first start of this league campaign, to get a sort of decent start up before we head off to beautiful Uzbekistan. Actually, of course I can't go there, but even if I could, I probably can't drink, can I? Because it's a Stan. But yeah, so that's definitely off the Amir Timur Museum. Will have to wait. But I think we're going for it this year. Whether that means we'll do better this year, I don't know. And I think there was a bit of naivety in the past. I think 2017 we did probably better than we thought we would. And because of that, 2018 was a disaster. We were probably, or Oniki probably thought he knew exactly what he was doing and kind of messed it a bit. But when you look back at the squads that were playing those games and compare them to the teams that we're putting out now, the sort of some of the players that are getting starts is quite surprising. So I really hope we can give it a better go this year, because yeah, it will shut a few people up if we do well. So
yeah, how well equipped do you think they are, Sam, to make a proper push at it this year? Obviously, a class above the rest of the J League that hasn't always counted in continental play. Of course, though, we've had plenty of examples of top quality and defending J1 champions getting bounced out of group stages over the years. But I don't know. Do Kawasaki have the required street smarts and the militia ingrained in them to go far enough in this competition, do you think? Or will they just be able to do it on pure class this time around?
I think they've got a really good mixture of both, actually. I mean, you've got the players, that spine of the team, which includes Jessel and Taniguchi. I think they're suited for it. I think the way Tanaka's playing alongside Schmidt, I think that's very well suited for Champions League. And Leandro Damião has all the experience as well. So I think that spine will see them through, and they've got the class as well. I think it'll help that this group is just in a centralised location. All they have to do at this moment is focus, on those games. They don't have to be playing in the league one at the weekend, then flying out somewhere to an ACL game. So I think that helps as well, just having that focus. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this Kawasaki team in action on the continental stage. I think they should be targeting winning the competition. I know Neil will probably not say that they're favourites for that or anything like that, but I think they have a reasonable group as well at the moment. There's Beijing Guan, are a decent team, but I think there are better teams in the competition than them to have as the next seed in that group. And then United City of the Philippines, I think they'll be quite happy with that team in their group. And then Daegu and Chiang Rai, I think, are the playoff team, and Daegu kind of just got in through the back door, and they're not the strongest Korean team, and Chiang Rai again they'd expect to beat. So I'd be very confident in Kawasaki, at least through that group stage. Once it gets to the knockout stages, every game becomes tough. I know that's a cliche, but I think the standard in Asia is usually fairly similar when you get to that stage, so it can be a bit of a lottery there. But yeah, I just look at that Kawasaki squad, and I just think I don't think Japan in recent memory or in the modern era have sent a stronger side to the ACL as this current Kawasaki team.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, well, Neil, we'll leave it there, I think. I'm not sure if even in your wildest dreams you could have imagined that your team would be on a better pace than they were after 15 games of last season. But, yeah, you'll just be enjoying the good times rolling, and, looking forward to obviously catching your side in action over in Uzbekistan in the next 6 weeks or so. So, for now, we'll leave it there. Thanks for your answers to all of those questions from our patrons. Thanks to Charlotte and Michael as well for getting theirs in. And, we'll catch up with you down the road. And, may the good times continue to roll.
Cheers. Thanks a lot for having me. And always a pleasure to speak to you guys. And good luck with the rest of this megapod.
Thank you very much. All right, well, yeah, thanks again to Neil. Sam, we've just got the lazy 9 more games to review, so we'll play a quick hit of music and then we'll crack on with the rest of them. Welcome back, and we'll begin to work our way through the rest of the J1 Match Day 13 slate by beginning on Saturday at the Toyota Stadium, where Nagoya looked to bounce back from their double defeat at the hands of Frontale when they hosted Cerezo Osaka. And Grampus were able to do so, and they're back on the clean sheet bus, Sam, after a 1-0 victory over the pink half of Osaka, who were up in arms initially about the goal scored by Yutaka Yoshida in the 66th minute, but it turned out it was just a lovely pass from their own centre-back, Thiago.
Yeah, it definitely looked offline to start with, but yeah, it comes in and Thiago with a wonderful back heel into Yoshida. It's a fantastic assist, unfortunately, for him. But yeah, no complaints can be had, and yeah, Nagoya got the win. It was a perfect result for them, at least, after the two games against Kawasaki. There wasn't a great deal in this game. There was a few long-range efforts for either side before the goal, but yeah, Nagoya will absolutely take it, and yeah, they're back on track, which is, yeah, the only thing they wanted out of this game.
Indeed. So, yes, yeah, Grampus clean sheet watch. It's now 11 from 15 games. Obviously, their goals conceded column took quite a hit in those two games against the defending champions. But, yes, it's a 10 conceded from 15 games with 11 clean sheets. We had a couple of questions on Grampus from Grum Freche. Sam, yeah, a couple, well, we... I think he's a repeat offender with the questions about Yoichiro Kakitani, and he's probably well aware that Kakitani's not your favourite player running around in J1 these days. The first question concerns Kakitani and Manabu Saito, who Graham Fletcher says were both players that the front office wanted to bring in, but they're not necessarily Ficcadenti. Could that be a reason why Kakitani continues to play game after game after game? Or does Ficcadenti really see anything in Kakitani on the pitch while Sato is strictly degraded as a bench player?
I mean, I don't know Ficcadenti personally, but he doesn't strike me as a sort of person that is going to just accept a player being pushed on him and say, you have to play him. And, I mean, he's been given Saito. He doesn't, as Granfredo mentions, he doesn't start him in many games at all. So I think he sees something in Kakitani, and there is a good player in there. And I thought the first game against Kawasaki, he actually played quite well. I don't personally see it when you've got the other players like Gabriel Xavier. I play ahead of him, and Hiroyuki Abe has just gone missing for most of this season. But yeah, I don't think that there's any pressure on Ficcadenti to play certain players. He must see a link, a reason to play Kakitani. Must fit into his system better. So, I mean, they're getting results, so who am I to argue with that?
And Graham Freche's second question concerns the manager specifically. Obviously, with his team in second in the table, having finished third last season, but Graham Freche is perhaps considering a change at the top at Grampus. He says that Ficcadenti won't change, so will the board continue to go that way of risking unhappy, expensive players and unattractive football and form the team Ficcadenti wants? Or do you guys think they will change something regarding the manager position, or just continue to bring players in that get media attention but are unwanted by the coach?
I don't know. I think this is an unfair question, to be quite honest with you. I think Ficcadenti has brought in players that would work for him. I don't think there are necessarily any people angry or disappointed the way that they're playing. I know it's not necessarily everyone's cup of tea, but it's getting results. Grampus have been taken. Ficcadenti had them where they were yo-yoing between J1 and J2 for a couple of years, and had them in the ACL last season. They have them second this year. I mean, it's not necessarily pretty, but bar the two games against Kawasaki, which most teams are going to lose to Kawasaki. So I think he's done a really good job. I mean, yeah, it might not be pretty, but yeah, I think in general, I think he's doing a fantastic job. So I imagine this will continue. I know Kakitani's not necessarily the greatest signing ever, and they've missed out on Juncker, who looks like a big loss the way he's playing for Urawa. But otherwise, I think the players that he's brought in have been very good. I mean, Inagaki was a Figadenti signing, and he's been one of the best players this season. So, yeah, I have no real complaints about the way Figadenti's going about his job at Grampus.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Grant Frecce, talking about kicking a man while he's down. Obviously, Ficadenti's stuck at home with the corona, with the Bruno Conca filling in the dugout for him, and you want him out the door. So I don't know. I think you're a hard man to please, Grant Frecce. We obviously really appreciate your involvement in the podcast, and you obviously want the best for your team, and we can obviously see and read your passion coming through. You want a better product on the pitch for your team, and you know, that's obviously a conundrum that supporters of different teams have to deal with. But yeah, I agree with what Sam said there. I mean, the results have been pretty hard to argue with in the last couple of years, and with your team second, and I don't think there's too many arguments so far. The best of the rest so far, although Yokohama F. Marino is certainly knocking on that door at the moment, and obviously Tosu have surprised so many of us this season. But yeah, to see Nagoya, I think, yeah, remain up at the sharp end of the table has been quite a feather in the cap of both Massimo Ficadenti and obviously Bruno Conca stepping in and his the rest of his coaching staff. So I wouldn't expect the Grampus board would fix anything if it isn't broken, and we'll wait and see how obviously things pan out for the rest of this season for Nagoya. But I would imagine that Ficadenti will be there, and obviously for the way I see it, the results he's gotten so far are only strengthening his position. We'll have more questions from Grant Frecce later on in the podcast, but mate, thanks for those first of your lot this week. Tosu actually slipped a spot down the table from third to fourth in this match day, but in getting their 0-0 draw against Hiroshima out of the way, we're wrapping up the three games from Saturday, Sam. This did look like quite an entertaining 0-0. Quite a number of chances that I'd typed out. I think time is of the essence here, so I won't run through them all in a terrific amount of detail, but it did look like quite an open game, and one of the better 0-0s you'll see.
Yeah, definitely. I think both teams kind of went for it a little bit. Hiroshima were playing Ayakawa up front. They decided to move away from Junior Santos, at least for the time being, because he's not quite getting the job done. But they looked bright, both teams. They both hit the post. They both had keepers make very good saves. There were a little bit of defensive indecision on occasion. So I thought it was a really exciting game. It's a shame it finished 0-0, but I think both teams will come away with it quite happy with the draw.
Indeed, and Hiroshima, decent performance, bouncing back from a couple of ropey ones in recent times, but that also saw them slip down a couple of spots in the table, and they are now a 10th. They're struggling in the form table, but this was at least a decent showing against obviously a Tosu side that is flying high so far this season. Taking over from Tosu in the third spot in the table is Yokohama F. Marinos. Sam, luckily for you, there is no hat on the menu at the Robson household this week. You said you'd eat yours if this home game against Kobe ended 0-0. It did not. F. Marinos up to third after a 2-0 home win over Vissel.
Yeah, I was slightly worried to start with, actually, because the game was played, it was very hot by the looks of it, and the game started at quite a slow pace, and neither team were really going for it too much, and I think, oh no, it's going to peter out, I'm going to be made to look a fool again. But yeah, it did pick up. I thought Marinos played very well. They obviously, the biggest threat that Kobe have is Furuhashi in behind, and the way they've been playing quite quickly at them. But I thought the midfield pairing of Kida and Ogihara pressed so well, and And it's not usually the case where Marcos Jr. goes off injured and you think that's actually benefiting Marinos, but it did allow Jun Armano to come on. He's a little better defensively in the way that he presses as well, so he helped that midfield really take control and stop many of the balls over to Furuhashi. I think he had one or two which he didn't take advantage of, but generally speaking, Marinos were there. And then Armano in possession was key to both goals. I thought, yeah, he played very well. The ball out to Tiraton, where, and then he crossed it in, and Vermaelen, unfortunately for him, diverts it into his own net. So, but yeah, generally speaking, Marinos were the better team. Kobe just didn't quite release Furuhashi enough, and yeah, Marinos again. It's the defensive side of the game, I think, is the big improvement for them this season. It's the reason they are higher in the table than they were last year, and yeah, it's really good to see. And I said that this was going to be the game where, after a few quite comfortable victories in recent weeks, Kobe were going to be a bigger test, and they've overcome that very well, even though Kobe kind of reverted to form for the second goal.
yes indeed. And yeah, actually a question coming up, another one from Graham Fritcher, and yeah, mentioning the fact that Yokohama's defence has been a lot better this season. But yeah, you mentioned Vermaelen's own goal 4 minutes before half time gave F. Marinos the lead, and then yeah, Armano tapped in from 6 yards after Daya Maikawa saved from Elber after he'd gone walkabout, and then obviously he's a bit knackered, Maikawa, so he simply stayed on the floor after saving Elber's shot, and yeah, Armano able to tap in from the edge of the 6 yard box. It was a couple of those from Maikawa in this game, wasn't there, Sam? There was the one early on where Kikuchi saved his blushes after Kikuchi had made a mistake to let Maeda in, Daisen Maeda in the first place. But I guess you take the rough with the smooth with the Kobe goalkeepers. It's something in the water down there, isn't it? That they're prone to go walkabout. And I don't know. It was puzzling though, wasn't it? Mike Curry just seemed to stay on the floor. Don't know if he was admiring that save he'd made from Elber, but he just didn't react at all, did he?
Well, I hope he wasn't admiring it, because he just pushed it right into danger. I just don't know. He had a weird game. Like, generally speaking, since he's come in for Ikura, he's not been an Ikura-type goalkeeper. He's been a lot more sensible. But this game, I don't know what. I don't know if Ikura had given him a team talk before the game and it's got him fired up to go out for something. But yeah, it was just weird. And it's a shame for Kobe, because they'd been playing so well, or a lot better, and they'd looked a lot more solid. But yeah, this game, Kikuchi was getting involved in the mix-up as well after we talked him up last week. I mean, not again, Kobe. Sort yourselves out.
Just before we move on to the questions we have from our patrons that both concern F. Marinos, obviously in recent times Kobe had made a habit, I suppose, of rescuing points late on in games. There'd been quite a few dramatics from them recently. I guess towards the end of the game, their best chance came after Andres Iniesta, who came on just before the hour, and DAZN were very keen on highlighting basically every touch of his in their highlights package. But they were obviously right to show his superb through ball for Furuhashi in the 77th minute. Unfortunately, though, for Kobe, Furuhashi fired into the side netting. It was still 1-0 at that stage in the game, of course, Sam. But no late heroics here for Kobe. What do they put this result down to? Just a bit of an off day against a very formidable opponent? Or will they be really disappointed they didn't take anything from it?
I think they were just up against a team that figured them out. I think they rely on Yamaguchi having the ball and Samper having the ball, and then getting the ball quickly to whoever it might be, Furuhashi in general. But they just weren't allowed to do that all game. I thought the effort from those three in midfield was fantastic. Occasionally, once Iniesta came on, he's going to pull that ball out, and they just have to hope that Furuhashi misses it, and that's what he did. And yes, so they kind of got away with a couple from Furuhashi, but generally speaking, Yokohama were quite quite comfortable, I thought. And the J League, mentioning Iniesta there, he's got his a press conference tomorrow, and they've got to be desperate that he's not hanging up the boots, because that goes 50% of their content. So I'm not really sure what they'll do if Iniesta does decide to walk away tomorrow. But hoping for the league that maybe he's saying, oh, it's a 3-year contract extension. But yeah, I think we might be seeing the end of Andres Iniesta, unfortunately.
Yes, listeners, you might know what's happened there at that press conference by the time you listen to this episode. Unfortunately for us here, the timing just hasn't worked out where we're able to react to whatever the news is. I'm suspecting it might be Iniesta announcing a new line of his wines that might be sold on the Rakuten online shop. But, it's either that or he's retiring. So I'm a bit up in the air on it. At the moment, but as I say, yeah, you'll probably know what Andres is up to by the time you listen to this episode. So, the couple of questions from our patrons. Then I tell you what, Sam, we'll do Graham Freche's first. As we said earlier, he mentioned that they're playing some excellent defence these days. He says they're on fire and doing well. How are the chances that the last game of the season on the 4th of December between F. Marinos and Frontale at the Nissan Stadium could be a championship decider?
As a neutral, I would always love it if the last game of the season meant something and was an absolute decider. And what a game that would be if that was the case. But they're not going to catch Frontale. I just can't see it. At the moment, how many points are they behind? 14 points with 3 games in hand. So they've still got a decent amount to catch up, even if they win all 3 games in hand. Then you're relying on Frontale dropping points, which doesn't seem likely. I mean, as a fairy tale kind of ending to a season, I'd love that to happen, but I just cannot see Frontale not having wrapped up the title by the last game of the season.
Well, yeah, I mean, F. Marinos have been superb, haven't they? Well, in terms of unbeaten runs, since the opening day. But, it's simply the fact that they will be relying on Kawasaki to drop points, Graham Fretcher. I think that's the major stumbling block to your dream scenario, which would be fantastic, obviously, for all of us who are interested in the J-League and Japanese football. So, we'd love to see it, but I don't think Frontale are going to cooperate on that front, unfortunately. But, again, thanks for your question, and more to come. The next one is from Khalil, and Khalil is coming for you, Sam. Khalil says, this is for Sam, explicitly. After you mentioned on multiple occasions you weren't fully convinced by F. Marinos after their 2 results against the lowly and packed defences of Shonan and Sendai. Khalil went and rewatched the highlights of those 2 matches, and he noted that F. Marinos hit the post and bar 3 times against Shonan. Now they've played FC Tokyo, and hardly a huge scalp these days, and Kobe, and won convincingly and gone on a winning and a clean sheet streak. Sam, are you any more convinced?
Well, as I said last week, the Kobe game was the one that I wanted to see them play in. This was going to be a real test for them, and I think they've come through that very well. So, yeah, they've convinced me in this game that they are a good team. I didn't think they weren't a good team, but, yeah, I do want to see them play against these sort of teams. I went back and watched the Shonan game, and, yes, they did hit the bar, so I give him that. They had chances. They should have won that game. They didn't win the game, but probably should have done. The Sendai one, I think, is the bigger one in terms of they created very little in that game against a team that everyone else has kind of got chances quite easily against them and scored quite a few goals against them. So that was a game where I was a little bit disappointed in them. But since then, and generally speaking, since the first 2 games of the season, they have played very well. So I'll give them that. I'll say that, yeah, they're a very good team. But it's just that in terms of a title challenge, it's not necessarily that I think Marinos are a poor team. I just think Kawasaki are just that good. So and as much as I'd love a title challenge, as much as I'd love Marinos to be in a title challenge, it's just that I can't see Kawasaki dropping towards them. But yeah, Marinos played very well at the weekend, so I'll give them full credit for that.
All right, terrific stuff. Thanks for that, Khalil. Hope that satisfied you, Sam's answer there. Yeah, obviously, your side doing extremely well, and as we said, up to third with games in hand on both Grampus and Kawasaki above them. All right, next to three teams very upwardly mobile after match day 13, after home victories. Adjust your sets, listeners. That is Avispa Fukuoka up in sixth in J1 after a their club record fourth straight J1 victory, a 1-0 triumph over Kashiwa Reysol. They could have been behind in the first minute, and they were indebted to their goalkeeper, Masaki Murakami, for a double save from, firstly, Hayato Nakama and then Hiroto Goya. But it was their defender, Takaki Shichi, who gave them the lead 3 minutes into the second half when he headed Emil Salomonsen's corner back across Kim Seung-gyu and inside the keeper's right-hand post. The dream scenario for Fukuoka, Sam, it's rolling on. They're all the way up to sixth. Can you believe it?
Not really, no, but they've been terrific. I think in this game they rode their luck a little bit, quite in the first half. You mentioned the Murakami saves. There's the one chance in stoppage time, I think, at the end of the first half where Shihashi gets the crossover. Goya is there for almost a tap-in. And Douglas Grawley pulls out an incredible tackle to deny him. And that is just kind of what Avispa have been based on, such quality defending. And then at set pieces, no one can deal with them. They keep scoring from them. Salomonsson delivery is always on the money. And they're getting goals from it. It's not necessarily pretty, but it is very effective. And full credit to Avispa. It's a pretty incredible run that they've gone on. And they deserve their position in the league.
Yep, so they've moved up a spot after this win. And Kashiwa are back down to 15th. After this defeat, there were chances at either end in the last 15 minutes. First, Angelotti headed over for Reysol, and then their Fukuoka substitute, Wanma, channeled his inner Garincha with a mazy dribble, but then screwed his shot wide, some might say channeling his inner Wanma. In stoppage time, Goya headed too close to Murakami, and that was that. And yet, Fukuoka, a fourth straight J1 win. Absolutely tremendous from them. And Graham Frecce's back in action again, asking about Avispa. Are they the best promoted team since the championship-winning Reysol won? 15 games into the season, Sam. I don't know, sixth in the table. There's a lot of, fairly inconsistent teams in that mid-table pack, isn't there? And a run of four straight wins is obviously going to take you a number of spots up the table. In this case, I think it is a total of five for Fukuoka since they started their winning run. I think it's worth remembering, Graham Frecce, that they didn't win any of their previous five games before this four-game winning run. So they haven't had it all entirely their own way so far this season. I certainly don't want to take anything away from them and where they sit in the table. But I don't know, Sam. Recent results, they're on a wave that they'll obviously want to see continue. And with their upcoming fixtures, I think it's an excellent chance that they will continue to move slightly higher up the table. But I don't know. I think there is a glass ceiling for them in terms of their overall quality versus the very upper echelon of J1. Or am I being a little bit harsh there?
Yeah, I know I'm with you. I think they've played very well, but I just think they've not necessarily got the quality, as you say, against the better teams. But really, they've played very well. I'm trying to rack my brains about them in recent years, the promoted sides and which sides have done the best. Did Cerezo get promoted from J2 2016 and then go and play and finish third in 2017?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think they would be, you definitely consider them higher. I think Oita's first season where they came in, they took everyone by surprise. They were up there for a long while. So I think there are better ones than Avispa, not taking anything away from them. And the way that this season is at the moment, there are still teams playing varying amounts of games. So you would maybe argue that Urawa could go ahead of them, Kashima could go ahead of them. So as well as sixth looks, it's not necessarily a fixed position at the moment. But Yeah, I mean, they've played very well, and defensively, I haven't seen many newly promoted sides defend as well as Avispa. I will give them that. I think it's maybe a little bit of a reach to say that they're the best promoted team that we've seen.
Well, yeah, I mean, they are they're well and truly entrenched in the top half of the table now. I think we can say that. They probably will be maybe until the Olympic break. I think they're 7 points clear of 11th place to Sapporo now. So Fukuoka, obviously they're travelling extremely well, and as I said, with their upcoming fixtures, they have a chance to keep the good times rolling, because in their next four, they play Sendai away, Shonan at home, Yokohama FC away, and then Oita away. So all of those teams are down in the Shonan are outside the bottom six now, but the rest of them are well and truly inside it. So with the fixtures upcoming, I wonder if they'll become a slightly bigger fish when they're playing against those other teams now, who not that they wouldn't take them seriously to begin with, but they're a different proposition now that they're higher up in the table. But yeah, absolutely tremendous for Fukuoka, and another clean sheet here, which is positive. And obviously Murakami, who we'd given a bit of stick to earlier on in the season. I think in recent weeks, Sam, we've made our peace with him, haven't we? And we've tried to give him credit where it's due, because he has been in good form in this, not only in this winning run, but since his early season wobbles. Speaking of early season wobbles, I guess you could say that Urawa have had a few of those in recent times, but they continued their run of win-loss with a win at home against a second from bottom Sendai. This was a game of firsts for Reds. They had Zion Suzuki in goal and Kasper Junker starting up front. Junker scored in the Levain Cup in midweek, and obviously Suzuki was in for Shusaku Nishikawa, the veteran who made those two horrible mistakes in Urawa's loss to Fukuoka last week. So I guess firstly, Sam, it's quite a big story amongst the Red support, seeing Nishikawa shunted out and Suzuki in. Do you think this will be... it's hard to say, obviously. You don't know what Ricardo Rodriguez is thinking, but any chance this is a permanent move and Suzuki will be a fixture between the sticks for Reds from this point on?
I think it very well could be. I mean, the way he played in this game, it was very, very good. He made a lot of good saves. The one right towards the end from Martinez, I think, is a terrific save. And he looked confident. He looked commanding of his area. I thought, yeah, he did everything asked of him. And there's no way you can drop him after this performance. So as long as he continues with that, I think Nishikawa has a fight on his hands. I feel a little sorry for Nishikawa, because generally speaking, I think he's played quite well. But he had that one horrible game, and he's kind of paid the price for it, where you look at maybe players like Iwanami and Makino, who have both had moments this season and last season, a few seasons now, where they haven't played very well, but their position has been pretty much set. So it's probably the life of a goalkeeper, I suppose. But yeah, Suzuki, I'll give a lot of credit to him, because he was quite busy as well. It wasn't like he was out of the game at all. He had a lot to do, but he did a lot of it, well, most of it, in fact, almost all of it, very well. I thought he had a terrific debut.
Yes, and so what about the Danish striker up the other end of the pitch then, Kasper Junker? Junker, I'm not sure. I'm going to have to work on that pronunciation, I think, Sam. But so in for his first J1 start. He had a chance in the 15th minute when Yuki Muto crossed for him, but he was unable to get over the ball and headed over the bar. But it was a lovely setup with Muto heavily involved just before the hour, and Junker made his mark on the Reds' first team with a first goal, a very neat finish past Jakub Slovic.
Yeah, really good build-up, the movement from Muto and Koizumi, I think it was, with the back heel, Junker, then he just slips off his defender, creates the space for himself, one touch and a clinical finish, and yeah, he's looked really good for that. Well, I think he's played an hour in both games so far, and the goal in midweek, I mean, the goalkeeper could have done better, but again, the movement just to drift off the defender from Junker, make the space, and yeah, gets it on target more often than not. I think he looks like a really clinical striker. I mean, he's just kind of like a throwback old school number nine in that he's going to operate between the lines of the 18-yard box. That's where he's going to be. He will make space. You've just got to find him. And yeah, Uraua did that in this game and he took his chance. And yeah, just looks like a really good signing for them. And Nagoya will be kicking themselves that they didn't manage to land it.
Yeah, a terrific start to his Reds career. Absolutely. Sam, it sounds like you're going with Juncker, so I will do the same. So, well, obviously, positive impacts for Juncker and Suzuki in their first starts for Reds, and then a veteran in the form of Yuki Abe sealed the win with 15 minutes to go with a lovely free kick from 25 yards in at Slovic's left-hand post. There was, obviously that late save from Suzuki flying to his right to tip over Martinez's 25-yard curler in the 86th minute, and that preserved the clean sheet. And, Suzuki will be very proud of that, I'm sure. And, that 2-0 home win for Reds saw them move up a spot in the table to 8th. Also up a spot is Kashima Antlers after an absolute walk in the park at home, 3-0 over FC Tokyo. I tell you what, Sam, every game this season so far for FC Tokyo, with the exception of one that I haven't been able to watch live, I have watched them in full without knowing the score, and I think they've got me beaten down because it got late enough on Sunday night where I realised I wasn't going to be able to watch the whole thing, so I just flicked through the highlights, and I'm very glad I didn't sit through the entire 90 minutes of that, because, the highlights just look like absolute dross. But the listeners don't want to hear me talk about FC Tokyo again and, tie myself up in knots and sound like I'm speaking in tongues. So this was, as I say, as easy as Kashima could possibly have wished it to be against a completely feeble opponent that looked like they were completely broken.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, I don't know how you managed to make it through the highlights, to be honest. Because I looked at the team that was put out, and I think I said to the Tokyo Kai guys on Twitter, I think it made me physically sick to look at that team because it was horrendous. You played a 4-4-2 with no creativity. Aoki and Arthur Silva in midfield, Higashi there, Mita there, and it looked like you were just trying to launch the ball towards Nagai and Diego Oliveira, and they have to do something with it. But it was just a really poor performance. So defensive, no ambition at all. The two in midfield, you might as well have put cones there for the amount of pressure they put on Misao and Leo Silva, who had so much time, and they are one of the best midfield pairings we have in the league. And if you give them all the time in the world, they're going to get past you, they're going to score goals. The defence wasn't much better. You gave too much space to them on the edge of the area. It was just like the defensive performance from last week, they just looked at it Hasegawa and thought, okay, the way we deal with this is just to drop deep and that'll sort everything out. But you just dropped deep and just didn't put any pressure on anyone. So Kashima were quite easily going to get their way through. And it was just at half time they made two changes. All it was, they brought more defenders on for Tokyo. And I mean, how do you look at that as a Tokyo supporter and be excited and positive for the second half when you're just bringing on more defenders? And it was just, I'd feel frustrated for you and all FC Tokyo supporters. No Shuto Abe, he was left on the bench. Leandro has gone AWOL again. You've still got players like Adalton and Tagawa who had played well at the start of this season. They were just an attacking option and really positive, but Tokyo just came into this game. They didn't look like they wanted to go for it. I think, was it two shots and naught on target? It was just, it was horrible. And yeah, I mean, Hasegawa, I think his time may be coming to an end pretty shortly.
Well, yeah, I mused last week whether he might have begun to have lost the dressing room. And again, in a performance like this where there is just absolutely no, seemingly no desire, there's no passion to compete. It just looks like, as I said, yeah, the team is just it's just completely broken. A fifth straight J1 defeat has seen them tumble down to 13th in the table. We better give the Kashima goal scorers their due, though. It was Koki Machida who headed in a Ryotaro Araki corner in the 22nd minute. That came after Antlers had won, three straight corners at Tokyo, just completely unable to get out of their own area. Then on the stroke of half time, the young striker Yuta Matsumura was not closed down on the edge of the box by Tokyo's captain, fantastic Keigo Higashi, and Matsumura lashed in a 25-yard laser beam in off Go Hatano's far post. The result was never in doubt, obviously, but Antlers added more salt to Tokyo wounds with the 3 minutes left. ISA Wada credited with the goal after he made contact with the Yasushi Endo's ball in from the right, although the ball did go in finally off the FC Tokyo substitute, Takumi Nakamura. Sam, it was 19 shots to 2. Completely spineless performance from Tokyo, and there have to be major questions asked now. As we said last week, just 4 months after they won the Levain Cup, it now looks like the situation for the manager is becoming untenable, although, you know, it does seemingly appear that it's just a personality clash between Kenta Hasegawa and Neil Debnam's best mate Leandro, who was obviously back on Twitter tweeting up a storm on Sunday, not in the match day squad, but letting everybody know that he is fit and available. So, there's obviously no mystery now at all about what was going on behind the scenes about his absence earlier on in the season. Unfortunately for me, Sam, we did get a number of questions from our patrons on FC Tokyo. Johnny's back with another one. Johnny Nickel, thanks, Johnny. Said that, he saw many Tokyo supporters supporting Leandro for his comments on Twitter. But do you, I'm presuming he means me, think the best way for the club to move forward is for both Hasegawa and Leandro to leave in the near future? I guess, Johnny, in situations like these, it's usually one or the other. Obviously, the club would have to sever contracts with both gentlemen, which might end up being quite pricey. I think at the moment, I don't know. I think the active support, they do tend to back the manager, don't they? So I think a lot of the supporters you see on Twitter have Leandro's back, but I think the ultras are, not that they're against Leandro, but I think they do tend to be very allegiant to the club and therefore the decisions they make. So I think whether it's completely split down the middle or not, I'm not sure. But it's a very difficult situation. In most instances, the manager tends to win out, doesn't he? But if he has indeed completely lost the ears of pretty much everybody in the dressing room, then it might be time to act for the front office on the coach.
Yeah, I suppose it depends on the situation. If this was middle of last season and there was this falling out, I think then the player might be the one to depart. But in this situation, the manager, the team aren't playing well, he's under pressure. And I think in this sort of situation, it's going to be the manager that is the one that falls by his sword. I think Leandro would then, you'd hope that the new manager coming in would get something out of him, getting back to the way he was playing at the end of last season. But then again, if he then causes trouble for the next manager, then I think his chance would have gone and then he'd be the one out the door. But I think in this situation, I think Hasegawa seems like he's going to be the one that falls first.
Yeah, well, I just wonder about the people actually making the decision at the right at the very top of this club, of this organisation, and whether they're able to gauge the situation and make the correct decision. But we'll wait and see. Along similar lines, Graham Freche says, "Is if I needed reminding, Graham Freche, 5 straight league defeats, is the managerial change on the horizon, and if so, who could turn things around?" This was a tricky one for me because I wasn't really sure how high Tokyo should be aiming, Sam, in response to Graham Freche's question. whether an international coach is even a possibility at this stage, and whether you'd be in a Danny Poyato sort of situation where even though for those people that were quarantined and are now able to enter the country, whether there might be further restrictions down the road, what sort of a name FC Tokyo could go for in the, I still think, somewhat unlikely event that Hasegawa is sacked in the next couple of weeks. But anyway, I asked Scott McIntyre, and I asked also Alex Bishop and Thomas Pennington from the Kai guys what they thought about a possible managerial candidates if Hasegawa is shown the door. And I guess veteran listeners of the podcast will not be surprised at Scott's answer. He suggests that FC Tokyo hire former Frontale and Nagoya coach Yahiro Kazuma to turn the club around, not just the team on the pitch. A cultural change is obviously needed, Scott says, and I completely agree with that. And Kazuma would certainly shake things up. I don't think there's any question about that. Thomas deferred to Alex, who suggested Jose Moraes, but Alex notes himself that he's been just snapped up by Al Hilal, but he's the sort of coach that Alex would be looking for, a coach with that sort of profile. So whether it's a big-name domestic coach who's currently out of work or somebody we could poach from overseas with that sort of profile as a Moraes. We're already looking ahead. So hopefully the front office are as well, because this run of defeats doesn't look like changing anytime soon. The last question on NFC Tokyo before we can move on comes from Charlotte again. Charlotte Patterson, thanks for your questions this week. Charlotte, should we be worried about Tokyo? I certainly am, Charlotte. Charlotte says she doesn't think that Tokyo will be relegated, but we certainly look poor. Sorry, that was me saying we, not Charlotte. No registered shots on target against Kashima. As you mentioned earlier, Sam, Leandro being left out. Does Hasegawa need to go? It's such a fall since winning the cup in January. And that's it, isn't it, Sam? It's it seems like we can't have all of the good things as a Tokyo supporter. The high of January the 4th, and then 4 months later, everything is coming crashing down. This league campaign, as I said last week or a couple of weeks ago, it's now just slipped into irrelevancy unless we do get sucked down into the relegation dogfight.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think that Tokyo will get relegated, but at the moment, there are teams gathering towards the bottom that I'd say, well, there's Gamba, there's Kashua, there's Tokyo. These three can't get relegated, surely, but the longer the season goes on and the longer they stay in and around that, then you never know. I mean, this is the J League. There is often a team that shouldn't be getting relegated that does, but I think that you've had a really poor run of form, but there is enough quality in that team, be it for Hasegawa to turn around or be it for another manager to turn around, that you can get a lot out of that team to push them back into at least a comfortable mid-table. I mean, at the moment, you're still 7 points clear of the drop. One win takes you into the top half potentially, so at the moment, I'm not completely worried and panicking about Tokyo, but again, 5 games down the line, if you're where you are now or even further down, I think, then it begins to be a little bit worrisome for Tokyo, and the same would be said for the likes of Raison, the likes of Gamba.
Yes, most definitely. So, thanks to Johnny, Graham Fletcher and Charlotte for your questions on FC Tokyo. Hopefully, I've made a little bit more sense talking about the Gasmen this week. We'll move on. We still have a few games to go, Sam. And, there was some controversy down in Tokushima, wasn't there, where the hosts Vortis ultimately slipped a couple of spots down the table to 14th after a 2-1 home defeat at the hands of Consadole Sapporo. As we mentioned in part one with Neil, Anderson Lopez is now back on top of the Golden Boot charts with his brace here, taking him onto 11 goals this season. That's one more than Leandro Damião. In first half stoppage time, Taisei Miyashiro gave hosts Fortis the lead with a cheeky finish that he turned in from close range after Yuki Kakita had headed a corner to the back post on target. But then, Kakita was involved in, one of the major talking points of this game in the 56th minute that our patron, Peter, would like to get your thoughts on, Sam. Consadoli have ultimately scored a very nice goal when Jay Bothroyd headed down Akito Fukumori's cross and Anderson Lopez side-footed home for the first of his two goals on the afternoon. But Peter's up in arms, and I think he has a case. It looks like Yoshiaki Komai fouls Kakita as he blocks his run well inside the Sapporo half. The ref allows play to go on, and as Peter says, Sapporo score 15 seconds later. Were Vortis hard done to, firstly by the ref, and then by the VAR not going back to have a look at this?
Yeah, I think so. I think this was quite a clear foul. Komai gets nowhere near the ball. Kakita is pretty much in on goal if there's no contact, so I thought it was a clear foul. I don't really know why the referee didn't give it. And then Sapporo go down the other end. I think there's maybe 8 passes, I think, from that moment and that tackle to them scoring. And I think that the VAR should be able to go back. But again, it's a kind of grey area that I'm not really sure on exactly how far back they're allowed to go. I don't see any reason why they wouldn't be able to in this case. So it seems harsh to me. And I think Tokushima, the game did turn on that moment, because I thought Tokushima had started the game very well. They were in control, but then Sapporo get back into it, and then there was only really one winner from then on. So, yeah, I do feel for Tokushima. I think they've been harshly treated there.
Yeah, and then they were ultimately made to pay for their sloppiness at 12 minutes from time, when a poor touch from the keeper, Naoto Kami Fukumoto, presented the ball to Lopez on the edge of the box. He drove around the keeper and blasted in off the underside of the bar to win it for Sapporo. That this result saw them climb 3 spots up the table to 11th. They were, along with the Shonan, who we'll talk about next, they were the highest movers in either direction in the table after match day 13. So, Peter, thanks for your question. And yes, we feel your pain, mate. Yes, we do agree that you were very hard done to. Anderson Lopez, I'm not sure if this is a tongue-in-cheek question from Gabriel Anello or not, Sam, but a question for you. How much would you bet on Anderson Lopez winning the Golden Boot this season?
Nothing. But I mean, he's just... these two goals as well are fortunate, and I don't want it to sound like I've got some sort of beef with Anderson Lopez, because I really don't. I mean, him jumping into the moat is still one of my favourite memories from the J-League. But I mean, the first goal is headed down to him, and I think he kind of misses it, or maybe scuffs it with the right foot, and it goes in off his standing foot and into the top corner, when otherwise it would have been straight at the goalkeeper. And then the look he gets for the second goal, where Kaká tries to pass it back and Duchamp just gets in the way, and Kami Fukumoto takes a terrible touch, and it just presents him with a run-on goal. I mean, if he releases a DBZ at the end of this season, the Golden Boot winner, it will be the worst of those sort of things ever created. I mean, yeah, penalties, fortune, but take the luck wherever it comes, and full credit to him. I mean, yeah, you've got to ride that. You've got to take those goals, and if he becomes Golden Boot winner scoring that way, then all the best to him. But no, I don't think that... I still would not be backing him as top scorer. Kyogo Furuhashi, I think, and Leandro Damian, I think, just in general, as general goal scorers, they're better, they're more clinical, and I'd be backing those two. But, yeah, good luck to him. Well done, Anderson Lopez.
Yeah, fair enough. I think a better question from Gab would have been, will you eat your hat, Sam, if Anderson Lopez wins the Golden Boot?
I'll have to find a hat, but yeah, I'll put my hat on the line. There's a Patreon exclusive.
Very good. Yep, Sam chows down on the deep fried beret. Yeah, that would be a smash hit, I think. Yeah, absolutely terrific. Well, thanks for your question, Gab, and indeed, Peter as well. Sorry, mate. It's unlucky. But, yeah, Vortis, yeah, keep on punching, hopefully. Actually, Sam, though, is there anything you could put your finger on this Tani Poyatos thing? Because he's been on the touchline for four games after missing, obviously, the first month and a bit or 2 months of the season. And he's seen his side lose all four games. Is he doing anything differently? Is his side doing anything differently on a game-to-game basis? Or have they just been stiff in some of these games? Or is there anything you can put it down to?
I was pretty critical of him last week when he wasn't playing his best players. Like, Kakita didn't start, and Nishia didn't start, and Watai didn't. And at least in this game, they looked better going forward. They brought Kakita back in, who's easily their main man up front, and Nishia had a lot of the ball in the first half, and they looked a lot more threatening going forward, but he still makes strange decisions. And the centre-back pairing of Kaká and Dusan Kvitinovic, I mean, it's not one that's been seen before. I mean, it's interesting. Kaká, this is his first start since coming, and obviously he's not played for a long time since playing in Brazil. And Dusan, this is his first league start in forever after he missed almost all of last season. So to put two quite rusty players in as an unknown partnership and taking out Fukuoka, who's been pretty solid, and generally speaking, Vortis have been pretty solid at the back, I thought it was a little bit weird. And I think that it was shown in the complete breakdown in communication for the second goal. And yeah, there's just every now and then he's making these weird decisions, and it doesn't make much sense to me when the previous coach, he got a formula that was working quite well. They were playing good football. They weren't losing many games. They were winning some. And he's come in, he's tried to change things, get him his way, which I understand. But the way the fixtures are, the amount of games that are being played, he doesn't have time on the training ground to really get it to work the way he wants to. So I think he'd have been better advised just keeping the status quo, maybe until the Olympic break, and at that point, then you can put your stamp on things and make things work. But I think he's just come in and disrupted things, if anything. And yeah, Vortis are on a little bit of a poor run, and yeah, they'll be soon towards the relegation zone if it continues this way.
Yes, the vibes were positive a few weeks ago under Takeshi Komoto, but as we say, since the Poyatos has come in, things have slightly gone south for Vortis on the back of four straight defeats, and they now 14th in the table, as I said earlier. Hopefully for Poyatos, first win as on the touchline as a Vortis coach is just around the corner. All right, well, I just mentioned it in the previous game, but yeah, Shonan are also up three spots in the table. They are now 12th after they made it 8 unbeaten, which sounds absolutely terrific, of course, but until you realise that six of those are draws. But still, they have taken 12 points from the last 24 available. And they won 2-0 at home over Oita. In, I guess, Sam, it just goes down as one of those key games that can come up at any stage of the season. But when a team in 15th plays a team in 17th, I mean, it becomes a relegation six-pointer. And Shonan have now given themselves quite a bit of distance between themselves and the relegation places. So this is a hugely important victory for them as they continue this very obdurate run. They've made themselves very hard to beat, and this is another good result for them.
Yeah, definitely a really good result. And they've been playing quite well. I mean, they've not quite got over the line in a few games. They were absolutely done by horrendous VARing last week. And they just deserve this victory. And they've got themselves now a 7-point gap, which at any stage of the season is crucial. And they look really positive. They've not conceding too many goals. They're starting to get a few more goals in them. I mean, Wellington has come in. I mean, everyone knows what his strengths are there in the air, but he's scoring some terrific headers. Don't think this is quite as good as this one from a few weeks ago, but it's another really good effort. And they're just working really hard. I think Nago has come in and then offered a lot into midfield, and they look a really positive team. And this game, they completely dominated Oita. Oita, bar the one chance they had where Watanabe has the effort, it's an unbelievable save from Kosei Tani, and Watanabe then puts his rebound off the post. But besides that, I thought Shonan were in complete control of this game.
Yeah, terrific stuff from Belmare. So as Sam's mentioned, Shintaro Nago gave them a 17th-minute lead. That terrific Tani save to Danai Watanabe came just before the hour. And then, the prodigal son, Wellington, heading in again in the 92nd minute. His second goal since his return to the club. This from a Masaki Ikeda cross in from the left. So, 8 unbeaten for Shonan. They move level on points with FC Tokyo are sliding down the table. And they've kept pace with the Sapporo. As we said, both teams moved up 3 spots in the table and both have 15 points. To the final game of the match day, Sam, and it was the second draw of the round, Tosu Hiroshima on Saturday, and then Shimizu Yokohama FC on the Sunday. And again, this game between two teams in the bottom six, this is one that Shimizu would have, not penciled in as a win. They would have, highlighted. They would put it in black permanent marker as a win that they would have, hoped to get their home campaign started. They are still yet to win at Nihon Daira in 2021 after a one-all draw. Thiago Santana's 58th minute goal for the hosts was cancelled out 5 minutes later by a terrific Kohei Tezuka free kick from 30 yards that, it must be said, did embarrass the S-Pulse keeper Shuichi Gonda at his near post. But, Yokohama FC will be celebrating every point they can get these days, Sam. But for Shimizu, we've spoken about it a number of times in recent weeks. This was another frustrating performance in a game that they had to win, surely.
Yeah, that's just so disappointing. That, as you say, you can't go have a home game against Yokohama FC and not come away with a victory if you want to be avoiding a relegation battle. And I have no idea how they didn't win this game, because they controlled it from almost the first minute to the last minute. And Yokohama have caught them with a long-range free kick that there's no way in the world Shuichi Gonda should be beating from there. I mean, it's a really good effort from Tezuka, and he's got that in his locker. He's a good set-piece taker, but really, Gonda will be very disappointed that that's gone in. And it was so quick as well after Shimizu were taking the lead, because it take them a while to kind of get through. Ichikawa, who came in goal, I think he's the third goalkeeper now they've used in the league, and he was making quite a few saves, quite unconventional often, with his feet at some stage, he was just flinging himself around, but it was doing the job. But Shimizu eventually got past him and then immediately conceded, and then just didn't seem to have it about them to go again, and just kind of the wind was taken out of their sails. And yeah, it's really disappointing for them. And Yokohama FC, I would say give them credit for the point, but other than the free kick, I don't think they did a lot. And it was just another game where Shimizu have just let themselves down and not taken their chances and not taken advantage of all the possession that they had. So yeah, really disappointing game for both teams, I thought. And Yokohama FC just, it's great for them that they've got a third point as they eke their way towards that, avoiding that record low points total. But yeah, I didn't see a lot from either team that made me very positive.
No, yeah. Well, we'll finish off our review of Match Day 13 with a final question from Graham Freche, and it concerns the relegation dogfight and the potential candidates for it. Graham Freche asks, if Vegalta, Yokohama FC and Oita continue the way they are going, they can't be saved. Who is your favourite to get the fourth relegation place and go down, obviously, at the moment, from what we've seen so far? So, just to set the scene at the foot of the table, listeners, Yokohama FC bottom on just 3 points from 13 games played. The Vegalta Sendai have 6 from their 12. Of course, Gunma Osaka are all the way down in 18th with just 7 points, but they've only played 9 games so far. Oita are 4th from bottom, and therefore in the last of the automatic relegation spots, they have 8 points from 12 games. Then S-Pulse are 4 points better off, Kashiwa 5 and Tokushima 6 before you get up to FC Tokyo Shonan, and then Sapporo, who are at the top of the bottom half of the table, if you like, on goal difference ahead of Belmare and FC Tokyo. So, Sam, I'll go first, and I guess it appears I'm probably stealing your answer, but at the moment it's Shimizu for me, presuming that Gunma are going to get better And presuming that FC Tokyo can't sink that far, while obviously Tokushima are going to have to smarten up their act, at the moment for me, Shimizu just haven't done anything towards suggesting that they're capable of pushing up into mid-table, even though I do accept the fact that they're only 3 points off 11th. They for me, are more likely to slip down than they are to rise up.
Yeah, I'd be with you as well on Shimizu. I just think they've been really disappointing. There is still talent in that team, and I think they should be able to get out of it, but you're just looking at it, you've got to think that Gamba are getting out of it. I know we say that every week, and they still have only 2 goals in 9 games, but still, you've got to think they will. And you think Kashima have got enough about them, Tokyo have got enough about them. So then you're looking at Sapporo, Shonan, Tokushima and Shimizu, and of those four, I think Shimizu, they're just kind of lacking something. They're not really a team that can score goals and get out, like kind of make the most of their dominance. So you say that Vortis, they've shown it this season that when they are playing at their best, they've got a few goals in them, they've got a few good talented players there, and Shonan have just looked... they've just looked a lot more fighting Shonan, I think, than the other two. And Sapporo, I think, are the best team of that out of these, but they've always got that Achilles heel at the back. But I'd be saying between Tokushima and Shimizu, and at the moment, just based on the way that they've played this season, it have to be Shimizu. But Tokushima really have to book their ideas up, otherwise they'd be the ones dragged in.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, thanks for that, Sam. And thank you ever so much, Graham Freche, again, for your questions throughout this episode. Absolutely, hugely appreciated. And obviously, to all of our patrons who submitted questions, we very much appreciate it. Yes, you've kept the podcast ticking over this week. And, huge contributions that we very much are thankful for. And, so that's it for Match Day 13 then. Just a quick look ahead to, firstly, Wednesday night. There will be 3 games played involving Champions League clubs. Kawasaki hosts Sendai and Gamba Osaka entertain Hiroshima in games pulled forward from Match Day 20. And also on Wednesday, Nagoya host Kashima in a game brought forward from Match Day 21. So, I guess they'll all be interesting for their own right, in their own right. Kawasaki hoping to avoid a banana skin against a second from bottom. Sendai, Gamba crisis watch as they host Hiroshima, looking for a goal of any sort. And then, obviously, Nagoya, the clean sheet machine against Kashima, who rolled over FC Tokyo on Sunday. I'm sure Nagoya will be a much sterner opponent for Antlers, though. And, as has become customary on the podcast in recent times, we will end this week with Sam's pick of the weekend. Match Day 14 takes place on both Saturday and Sunday. 8 games on the Saturday and then 2 on Sunday. Sam, what is your pick of the weekend?
Well, I kind of alluded to this earlier without actually knowing the fixtures, but Sunday, Kawasaki against Sapporo, and if you're looking for maybe a banana skin where Kawasaki slip up, this is what happened last season where Sapporo picked up a really strange victory against them. But generally speaking, games between these two sides are really exciting. Sapporo are going to be a team that go up and try and attack Kawasaki, which is what we've been asking for. So let's see if it can work, and let's see if they can go and get a victory or get some points away from Kawasaki. So, that will be my game of the weekend.
All right, terrific. So that is a Sunday, a 3 p.m. kickoff in Japan at Todoroki. And, you never know what you're going to get from Sapporo, do you, Sam? So, it could be anything. It could be a repeat of, the game that Sam's referencing from last year when Consadole rocked up to Todoroki and won 2-0 when, Sam's favourite Sapporo striker, Anderson Lopez, was on the score sheet for Sapporo on that particular occasion. So we'll look forward to the games in midweek, and then we'll round up all of the Match Day 14 action in next week's episode. Look forward to doing that again with you.
Yeah, me too. And our patrons maybe look forward to something dropping maybe Wednesday evening about those three games. I'll try and get a little bit of a write up for those ones. They all look pretty interesting on paper for one reason or another. And yeah, it'd be great to catch up with you, Ben, next week after the next weekend's round of fixtures.
All right, terrific stuff. So, yeah, that is it for this week's episode of the JTOG podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Neil Debnam for his time on this week's episode. Obviously, all of our patrons who submitted questions at the moment, too many to name off the top of my head, but you guys know who you are. And, yeah, we very much appreciate your contributions, as we do for all of our patrons who support us at patreon.com/JTOGpod. And, listeners, of course, you know we very much appreciate you as well for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 14. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The JTOG Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.